Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
The corporation is a dictatorship. That's what it is, right? I mean, you have no rights economically, right? You can be fired at any time for any reason, right?
Yeah, but you can leave. You're not going to be sent to Siberia.
I've got something a little different today in the form of a bit of a debate. This is episode 101 or 101. And while the previous 100 have had all sorts of weird and wacky and crazy people, from psychopaths and pedophiles to cult survivors and former terrorists, there haven't been many interviewees who, at the time of the interview, held viewpoints ideologically opposed to my own. I've avoided that for several reasons. One, I fear being exposed for my lack of knowledge and debating prowess. Two, is it a misstep to platform ideas that I find dangerous or plain wrong? Because the people who are fanatical about their particular belief are bound to know far more about their topic than I. And three, will I be tarred with their beliefs and the negativity around their beliefs by association? But I suppose that's a little cowardly of a reason not to have these people on. But when you're 100 episodes in, you think, oh, come on, what's the worst that can happen? And so I invited communist and self-described Stalinist Dr. Acetar Behr on the show. Acetar is an activist, professor, teacher, and author of Prison Labor in the US, an Economic Analysis. He teaches economic theory at Riverside City College in Southern California. He's written over 200 articles for the Börsen Kurier, Austria's oldest weekly financial newspaper. He has a YouTube channel with his lectures on economic theory, youtube.com/AcetarBehr. Follow him on twitter.com/AcetarBehr. I'm aware that some people will have quite a dramatic response to the concept of a defender or purveyor of communism. I totally understand if this one is too much for you. For those of you who stick around, prepare for an open discussion of communism. Now, I'm by no means qualified to have this debate, but I do stand on the capitalism side because I love stuff. I love stuff and I love working really hard and I love the idea of progressing on a ladder and moving up in the world, but I also understand the pitfalls. But I'm one of those boring people who say, well, you know, it's probably the best of a bad bunch in terms of structures that we have that can make as many people as possible as unhappy as they can be. Anyway, Acetar, being an economics professor, it means I can't really win this debate. So it's not really a debate as such. It's just he sort of talks to me about his ideas. He and I essentially disagree about certain tenets at the core of humanity and how we want the world to look. We also find a lot of common ground, and I think we should be having more frank chats with people on the other sides of the spectrum, the people on the edge. In some respects, I find it hard to reconcile the mild-mannered, handsome, white-bearded man in front of me with the defender of Stalin, a man who had millions of people die of starvation, millions more sent to labour camps. Acetar, as you'll hear, sees things from a totally different perspective. Even if you do consider him the enemy, it can't hurt to know what the enemy is thinking. As for me, I think of Acetar as a friend. It's not the first time I've interviewed him. I like him. I even find some of his views fascinating and enlightening, and others I find a little misguided. And he looks like Tom Hanks in Castaway, but with a white beard. He's polite and open to criticism, so I hope you get something of value from this. And please don't email angry comments about platforming dangerous views, because that's sort of the whole point of this podcast. That's what the podcast is for, platforming dangerous views. So without further ado, let's meet Dr. Acetar Behr. Is that look, is that something that happened in your sort of recent years, or have you always had quite a big beard?
Started growing it a little bit before COVID hit, and I teach meditation as well as doing political economy, and so I go on retreat and things, and went on a retreat, and I got this intuition to grow it out, and I was like, that doesn't seem that important, and plus it'll make me look a lot older, you know. So I didn't want to do it for a while, and then I was like, well, you know, I think it's good to, if you want to be more intuitive, you have to listen to your intuitive voice, right? So I'm like, well, all right, I'm going to do it. If it's not that important, then I'll do it, you know. And so I'll look older, all right, you know. And then it's you know, the byproduct was it gave me a different look, I guess.
Do you mind me asking? It's a rude question, but roughly how old are you?
I just turned 49. Was my birthday on Tuesday, in fact.
Oh, happy birthday. I don't know. I think maybe it does age you a little bit, just because it's a big white beard, but your face is very young looking.
It's a paradox, yeah.
It is. And also, I mean, sure, I'm sure people point this out, but it does have that sort of Marx quality to it, doesn't it?
People say I look like Marx. That's true. I also hear Santa Claus.
Yes. And I said to you before when we spoke on Sean Atwood's that you're very handsome. You've got very handsome features. Do people tell you that often?
You know, I have fans. I've got a few fans here and there.
Yeah, well, fair enough.
It's so nice.
Tell us a little bit about your background, like what you do as a professor and all that kind of stuff, please.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I teach at Riverside City College. That's a community college or junior college. I don't know that they have those in Europe, but, you know, it's like a 2-year college that's meant to be on the intro kind of level. There aren't a lot of courses that have prerequisites. There are a few, but, you know, mostly it's meant for students who are right out of high school. And then they, you know, prepare for, you know, the full degree, or maybe they take a career technical type of degree, or just, you know, it makes education far more accessible, right? It's a lot cheaper. California has really invested in the community college system. And so they're quite good. The facilities are excellent. It's quite different from, I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up in Boston, and there they don't have as good a community college system at all. So it's, you know, you're making more of a compromise, you know, like, so I wanted to teach here because I was like, well, you know, I'm into academic teaching and, you know, I love working with ideas. But you know, I don't want to exclusively, teach to rich kids. Right.
Of course you don't. You're a communist.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And, you know, I'd love to help out the working class if I can. Right. I mean, like, and so it seemed like, you know, community college would be a good fit. I mean, the big downside to it is it's an extremely elitist system that we have. So naturally, everyone thinks you're second or third rate, like if you're at a community college, right? So, you know, I see a lot of that on Twitter, right? I'm like, well, a community college professor thinks this, who cares, you know, like this.
That's horrible.
Well, it's, you know, elitism is all around us, right? I mean, that's sort of...
Sure.
That's part of the problem, right? You know, we tend to think that the rich are smarter and better, you know, I mean, like, despite all evidence to the contrary.
Yeah. What was your, not that it really makes much difference, but to get a picture of you, what was your upbringing like, especially in terms of class and that kind of thing?
I grew up in a kind of like spiritual hippie community, Western Sufism. And, you know, so I was exposed to a lot of, you know, philosophy and many different religious practices in my household. It's a big commune, you know, a bunch of people lived in a big old house. And, you know, I knew a lot of adults, like as a kid, you know, I had that, you know, I could sort of see a range of different adult behavior. And there weren't like a huge number of kids around in the house, although, you know, later there were more. I was like the eldest kid. And in terms of class, I would say we were sort of like, I don't know, somewhere, it's like middle professional kind of class, whatever that is. I mean, you know, when my parents were nowhere near rich enough to not have to work, they always both worked, right? But, you know, they had education and, you know, they had good jobs and so on. And so.
And your position as a communist, that is in the States. I mean, it's an extremely controversial position to take, I think, in most places in the world. And in the States, even more so, maybe, with the history of McCarthyism and that kind of...
It depends what class you're in, actually, right? I mean, You know, if we hear from the working classes, I think it's an uncontroversial position. But, you know, for somebody in my position, yes, rare.
That's interesting you say that, because I think, I mean, in the UK, I don't know enough about in the States in this respect, but in the UK, there has been a move for the working classes are voting more right wing and the privileged classes are voting further left. Has that happened at all in sort of stateside?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is one of the problems with this very strange left-right continuum, you know, that it doesn't really include class very much in it, right? I mean, it includes mostly social issues, and those social issues tend to skew along lines that, you know, deal with education, right? Like, so things like, you know, gay marriage or trans rights or whatever, right? These are issues that break along education lines, and you know, who gets an education, right? I mean, that's a class-based thing. But I think if you ask people, should we allow there to be homelessness? Should everyone have healthcare? Should we guarantee everyone a job? I think you'll find nearly universal agreement among the working class. And, you know, I mean, we saw that, like, the enormous popularity of Bernie Sanders, or even of Corbyn, you know, like, I mean, that, you know, these are figures who have, you know, spoke to those issues, were not able to do much about those issues, actually. And that's another issue. But, you know, and I think it reveals how much people want things to actually be quite different than they are. There's a long playbook of this, right? A long fascist playbook of using, you know, the reactionary elements to gain populist support. And, you know, that's extremely dangerous. I mean, and of course, many capitalist nations open themselves to this by suppressing communism, right? They suppress real working class populism. And then you get the fake kind, you know, you get the kind that uses racism, toxic masculinity, appeals to narrow religion in order to gain political support. These are never majority support positions. All you get from this is you get a zealous group of people who defend that. They're still a minority, right? But a zealous minority can often carry the day in, like, a, you know, in a liberal democracy, because, you know, not everyone votes, right? Or in a parliamentary system, you know, a strong bloc, even if it's a minority, can often have an outsized influence, right? So
what do you think of, say, Jeremy Corbyn then? Because to me, he was a populist who employed populist tactics. And also, I would have said his followers, again, they were obviously a mix of people, but a lot of them were privileged, university-educated students.
Yeah, I mean, the same with Bernie Sanders in the United States. But it's a segment of that, right? You know, it's not like, you know, every university educated person, right? not at all. There's support across the classes for that, I would say. It's interesting to me that young people are often, you know, whatever their class, right, they're often the most supportive of things like that. You know, I know less about UK politics, so I can't slice and dice that demographic as well. But we certainly saw that with Bernie here.
Yeah, I somebody was saying, who was it? Daniel Finkelstein, who's a commentator in the UK. He's very centrist, and he had, I think his father was in a labor camp in the Soviet Union. His mother was in a concentration camp. So he had sort of both, and he sort of, for him, he sees the perils of both sides. And he was saying, about how there's a lot of evidence about younger people like that. They tend to be further on both ends of the spectrum. So for example, he uses Vietnam as an example. So the people who were the most anti-war were the young people, the students and that kind of thing. But also the people who were most pro-war were also the young people and students and that kind of thing. So for him, it's that just young people are a little bit more extreme. Does that hold true to you?
I don't know. I don't see a lot of... I don't know of a lot of pro-war young people. I think of, you know, this, at least in the US, I mean, the pro-war position tends to be, you know, this very, like, pragmatic, you know, realpolitik kind of moment, you know, or like the, I mean, I think too, that young people know that they're more likely to be the ones fighting in it, right? I mean, than the old. I don't know how much of a role that plays, but although I think in the United States there is a certain machismo that can come in, you know, like a we're number one kind of, you know, that kind of energy. I don't know. I don't see a huge amount of that, but occasionally you'll see that. I went under an overpass the other day and people were, you know, waving US flags and stuff like this. And, you know, I don't know if this was exactly connected to, you know, Russia or Ukraine or whatever, but, you know, I was like, all right, what's going on up here? You know? So there's definitely that intense patriotic fervor at times here.
Yeah. I remember thinking about that, particularly in the US when Osama bin Laden was killed. And I just saw loads of videos of like very young student-y kinds of people in the streets saying USA, USA. And I just thought, I understand the excitement and stuff, but it's just this, I don't know, it felt like a younger person's game, the sort of celebration of war and I don't know, murder and stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's sort of like a superhero movie, isn't it? Like we've built up the great bad guy and then, oh, we got him. Oh, yay. Right. Like what, it's a kind of a sports vibe, you know? And then when you're older, you're like, well, I don't know if I can get excited about that as much.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell me a little bit, because I think here's the thing about communism. Obviously, so you were on Sean Atwood's podcast and I was there, and a lot of people in the YouTube comments, and they say mad things anyway, but they were very angry actually. So you must get a lot of that. And I try to sort of think, my way of thinking is always, I never want to moralize on this podcast. I never want to be like talking to whoever I'm talking to, oh, I've got better opinions than you or whatever. So I want, you know, I'm really happy you came on and we can talk about it. What effectively, I've got two questions here. What's the difference between communism and socialism? And what is the what is it that you would like the world to be like in layman's terms, if possible?
Yeah, that's a good question. What's the end result here? You know, communism is, you know, it has a kind of ideal, right? It has a kind of dream, right? Which is summarized in that old line, right? That you know, to each according to their need and from each according to their ability, this idea, right? And it's an idea that is hundreds, maybe thousands of years old, right? I mean, we don't even know, right? How long have people been dreaming of a society that is truly based on sharing, cooperation, even love, right? That is clearly not the basis of any modern society, right? I mean, like, look around, right? Like, if you love somebody, do you let them starve to death? You know, I mean, like, that is a very slow and brutal way to die. And you have lots of opportunities to prevent that, right? It takes a while to starve to death, you know? And yet, right, globally, 9 million people starve to death each and every year, right? I mean, that's, and the overwhelming majority are women and children. So it's something like 25,000 people per day. This does not make headlines, right? We barely notice it. Although, if you want to talk about, right, people will say, well, the Soviet Union killed millions of people and starved their own people, blah, 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 right?
Like, I could hear people saying that. I can imagine them saying it while listening about the starvation in particular.
Yeah, well, first of all, there's no case for the Soviet Union ever intentionally starving anybody. But secondly, you know, this is a routine matter that happens today, right? Why don't we do something about that? It would take a relatively small amount of money. We don't do something about it because capitalism, of course, accumulates great fortunes by taking the wealth from many people. I mean, that's the math. You know, we like to think it eliminates poverty for something. That's magical thinking. That's not grounded in math or logic, right? But back to the question of like, what would communism look like? I think the most honest answer is, how could we possibly have any idea, right? I mean, like what we know is capitalism, right? But like those of us who are, you know, from these countries, right? That's what we know. What communism might be like is an exercise in creative imagination, because a society that's not based on the brutal taking of wealth from the many in order to give it to the few, we just never have known anything like that anytime in modern history. So, you know, I don't know, and neither do you, right? I mean, nobody knows. But we have a kind of idea that it could be better, right? And I think that's important, right? Because everyone who's ever made anything better starts with a kind of vague idea, right? I mean, like, you can't let your lack of knowing exactly what it's going to be like hinder you. You know, you're like, well, I know this isn't good, and I think we can do better, you know? And then that's where socialism comes in. So socialism is like, all right, we start with a society that is where exploitation is interwoven into every aspect of it. And then how do we move away from that, right? And I think the most obvious and immediate answer is, well, let's do something about the most extreme effects of poverty, right? I mean, we have people who are homeless, right? We have people who are starving. We have people who are dying. I mean, in this country, at least, right? We have people who are dying because, you know, they're diabetic and they can't afford insulin. I mean, this is absurd and barbaric, right? So let's start there, right? Like, if we give everyone healthcare, have we changed the basis of society and made it non-exploitative? No, we haven't, right? But we are removing some of the worst effects of that exploitation. And I think that's where you start, right? Now, you know, socialism is always conceived of as a transition, right? It's okay, we're going from the exploitation of the feudal era or the capitalist era. And, you know, this is where you get kind of a departure within Marxism, right? Because Marx and Engels thought socialism would follow on the heels of the most developed capitalism, right? I mean, the contradictions would heighten. Workers would say, wait a minute, we all have the same interests. Why are we working for this tiny elite? Let's overthrow them. Let's be our own bosses. Let's do this, right? So they thought that Germany would be the place. They were actually close to being correct, right? Germany, did have a tremendous socialist communist movement, but it was blunted and then destroyed. And part of what did the trick there was giving workers some of this, right? That is the social democratic movement. And Bismarck was very explicit about this, right? He was like, if we don't give some concessions, the socialists might win, you know? So very interesting, right? And then we saw the revolution succeed in a place that had very little capitalism, right? Russia, I mean, probably the least developed nation in Europe at the time, largely feudal or emerging from, you know, its feudal history, dominated by agriculture. And so, you know, the Lenin and Stalin and Bukharin and these thinkers, right? They're like, well, we need to develop capitalism, right? I mean, that's the roadmap. We need to industrialize. And we don't, you know, we have an agricultural society. We're quite weak, right? I mean, you know, we lost to the Japanese, this tiny island, right? But the Japanese has industrialized. We have not, you know? So they said that's top priority, right? But how do you do that, right? I mean, did they still have an employer-employee model, right? I mean, they still pay people wages, right? There's still a surplus. It just goes into the hands of the state, right? So they have one employer rather than a bunch of private employers. And, you know, they had a word for this. And Lenin called it state capitalism, you know? And, it, you know, nowadays among the left, that is used as a kind of pejorative, like that's to say, oh, they didn't really have socialism or whatever. That's never what Lenin meant, right? Lenin was just like, hey, this is part of the process. This is a stage we must go through, right? I mean, we have to industrialize. what we can learn from the history of industrialization is that we can learn not to have it take 300 years or whatever, right? Like in the case of England, where industrialization proceeded slowly and organically, and there were setbacks and reversals. And, you know, the Soviets were like, we have Germany that is actively talking about how much they want to conquer us and turn us into their resource producing outpost, right? We don't have time. We don't have 300 years. We need to do this in 15 years, you know? And they were able to do that. It's a stunning accomplishment. They were able to do that by planning, by saying, these are exactly the inputs that we need. This is how much of them we need, right? We are going to get that done. And they did that because they essentially had only one entity, right? Only one corporate entity, rather than a bunch of corporations competing with each other with different interests, right? I mean, so they're able to eliminate some of that chaotic aspect of competition.
This is going to be an annoying thing to say, I suppose, but wasn't it also done so quickly because it was at the expense of so many millions of people who died?
Well, people didn't die as a result of industrialization. So no, I wouldn't say that at all.
Okay. But they were sent to the gulags, like, because for this system, for not industrialization as such, but if we talk about communism, the system, for it to work, doesn't it need pretty much everybody on board and everybody thinking the same way? And was that not why, you know, Stalin sent so many to the gulags?
Well, I mean, I think you could ask the same question of the capitalist system, right? Does it require everybody to be on board and everybody to think the same way?
Well, you don't get sent to the gulags if not.
Well, you know, there is a country that certainly has the biggest gulags in the world right now. That's the good old USA, right? I mean, this is what I studied and wrote a book on. You know, you get sent to prison and then you work there. I mean, in the Soviet Union, we call that gulag. Here we call it, I don't know what, incarceration, right?
It's not the same as these Siberian prisons, though, where people, it is awful. I agree with you completely. The prison system, in particularly in the States, in the UK as well. I've got somebody coming on soon who was in prison for a few years to talk about the dire situation, and I couldn't agree more with you on that. But I mean, there are levels, aren't there? And the gulags were torturous, weren't they? They were beyond anything we can imagine, the suffering that people went through in those.
Well, I think it has been quite a bit exaggerated, but you know, we have to consider that that Russia is a very poor country at the time of the revolution. They had the gulags come from the czars, right? I mean, the Soviets reduced the death rate substantially. It was about one quarter the mortality rate as it was under the czar. But, you know, we don't talk about how brutal the czarist prisons were, right? I mean, we talk about how brutal the Soviet prisons were. So I think there's a lot of hypocrisy and doublethink, and that's not really very well historically backed up when we consider these things. You know, gulags had maximum sentences. You know, I mean, let's admit that it was also a more brutal time. Like if we go back to the 1930s, like let's compare that to US prisons in the 1930s. I mean, you know, people were getting whipped to death in US prisons, you know, I mean, like they had convict leasing and so on. Right. I mean, this is, you know, it's a mistake to consider historical things by present day standards. Right.
That's true. But then also, I wouldn't want to compare it to the Tsar system because that's a monarchy. So that's not really comparing it to a capitalist system where we'd like to think, because the Tsar system, again, isn't that another situation where we don't have the sort of freedom that a lot of people would associate with capitalism and not with communism or a Tsar?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, right? What is freedom? What does that mean, right? I mean, like, you know, we talk a lot about that here in the United States, right? I mean, that's part of our mythology about how free we are, you know? But if you're free to die because you can't afford the insulin, you know, I mean, what does that mean, right? Like, you know, freedom in a negative sense, like, okay, well, nobody's going to tell you what you have to think or say, right? Okay. But is there any safety in your life, right? I mean, if something goes wrong, one thing goes wrong, say your car breaks down or something like that, then you lose your job, right? Then you lose your housing. I mean, you know, this is a society that has no net, you know? Does that give you freedom, right? I mean, like, how free are you when you're balancing on a high wire and you know you could fall and that would be very dire indeed?
Well, with regards health, I would say, again, the US system is much maligned, I think, around the world because, I mean, in the UK, of course, nobody's dying. I don't think, anyway, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but I think if you need insulin, you get that all on the health system over here and many other countries. And I think the US system is criticized for not having that, then would you still say, well, yes, but the UK needs to be more socialist and more closer towards communism?
I think you can do different things in a developed country than you could in a completely undeveloped country that's quite poor, right? United States and UK, these are both wealthy, developed countries. These are countries that have already industrialized, right? In countries like this, socialism is going to take a very different path, right? But, you know, in every case, you look at, well, what is it that people are asking for? What do they need? What would make their lives better, right? I look at this in terms of the US and China, right? Because China has done some interesting things in the last 10 years, including laying more high-speed rail than the entire rest of the world combined, right? So China goes from something like, I don't know, it's sixth place or something like this in the world to first place, and it's not even close, right? I mean, and you know, these are very fast trains, right? And this makes hundreds of millions of people's lives better, right? I mean, like, I don't know how much time you spent in the United States, but United States infrastructure is like crumbling, right? I mean, like, you look at the situation with roads. Go on a plane, right? Traveling on a plane is like barbaric. You know, the seats always get smaller, and they, you know, I'm a big person, right? So I always feel this, you know, like I'm like, do both of my shoulders need to be touching people on either side, right? You know,
hang on, that's a bit misleading for, because most people are only listening, and it sort of, you imagine a huge person. You look sort of, is it that you're tall?
I am. I'm 6 foot two and 230 pounds, you know, all muscle, of course.
So we don't seem chubby at all. You seem slim.
Yeah, I'm fit, you know. That's why I don't love being called Santa, you know, because Santa's so fat. You know?
What I'd say about China is China's a mixed economy, isn't it? It's not like an actual communist economy, is it?
Well, there are no communist economies, right? Because like I say, you know, communism represents the faraway ideal. We don't know what that would look like, right? We know what the transitionary state might look like in certain places, right? So China had a very similar problem, and they learned from Soviets, right? They studied the Soviet experience very, very carefully, which is good, right? And they said, yeah, we need to do much the same. They did a lot of similar things early on. And then they went through a reform period, right? They brought back and allowed private capital. And now they have mix, right? They have a substantial state control, and especially what they call the commanding heights of the economy, right? The key sectors, or what they consider to be key sectors, they've not privatized that in the slightest. So, you know, telecom and, you know, a lot of their like infrastructure sensitive things, right? They've kept that. So they have like what I would call from a Marxist class perspective, they have a mix of private and state capitalism, right? However, their government is extremely committed to socialism, right? And so they're like, and I don't think that they would even disagree with my assessment. It's not like, you know, I'm not saying this to slight China in any way, right? State and private capitalism, but the problem is that you can't just say they have capitalism, period, right? Because what China does is different from every other capitalist nation that you've ever seen. You know, that you do not see any other nation in the history of capitalism doing poverty reduction on the scale of China. You do not see even the kind of infrastructure investment, which is you know, investing in infrastructure is not anti-capitalist at all, right? I mean, capitalism needs infrastructure too, right? Like, but the Chinese do it far more systematically. I mean, their level of investment, their level of planning, of foresight, right? I mean, you know, you look at what they've done, and they have climbed the value ladder, right? I mean, they've gone from low-level manufacturing, the lowest level that you could have, right? Primary materials, right? To the most sophisticated electronics, cars, everything, right? Nanotechnology, right? I mean, they, you know, they're the biggest importer of high technology stuff in the world. High technology inputs, right? So this is interesting, and this happens over a few decades. I mean, you know, like compare China in 1955, let's say, right, where they are complete, they're just struggling to do primary product industrialization. You know, they've got backyard, you know, coal-fired iron pits and stuff like this, right? You know, to China now, right? It's like night and day, you know?
Again, I can imagine the listeners, I can imagine us saying, yes, but at what cost to individual liberty, to freedom of choice, to freedom of expression, to surveillance over there at the moment? And also, I mean, the elephant in the room being, I won't pronounce this right, but the Uyghur?
The Uyghurs, yes.
Yeah, concentration camps that are keeping them at the moment.
There are no concentration camps. I mean, this is a, you know, I'm going to just confront this. This is just a complete mythology right here. And this has been spread by Radio Free Asia, by Adrian Zenz. I mean, this is just nonsense. There's no genocide and there's no concentration camps. I mean, that's just a evidence-free idea that has been propagated in the Western press. You know, you've had hundreds of independent journalists visit. You know, the Muslim countries are not convinced by this either, right?
I've seen photos.
Yeah. Well, you know, what you see is that here's a map of different locations, which we are telling you are concentration camps, right? And then you zoom in on them and you're like, these are obviously schools. This is a running track on this thing, right? You can see that quite well from satellite images. You know, it's a kind of a hustle where let me give you more data than you can deal with and then take my word for it. You know, Zenz has done this analysis of like, oh, these are all the buildings that have fences and whatever, you know, like, guess what? A building with a fence is not necessarily a concentration camp. If it were, well, you'd have to conclude that the UK is full of concentration camps, would you not? I mean, you know.
Well, the thing is, yeah, but the UK is so open that anybody can go in. And obviously, I'm not so naive as to think that bad things don't go on behind closed doors in government in the UK and the US and other places. Of course, they do. But there's just countless stories of, you know, journalists and things going missing in China whenever they, you know, political opposition, that kind of thing. That's the kind of freedom of thought.
Well, these are stories which are, you know, I mean, like, we have to acknowledge that there's an enormous propaganda machine here. And you know, that takes everything bad that you could possibly put a spin on and attribute it to China and socialism. And, you know, this is what propaganda does. You know, I mean, propaganda is far more sophisticated in the West than it ever was in Russia, where the word comes from. Right. You look at Russian propaganda posters. These are the most wholesome, straightforward messaging you could ever imagine. Right. Like, two happy workers in a field, right? Like, that is, you know, when you talk about where is U.S. propaganda at, it's much more complicated. It's much more sophisticated. It plays upon much things that are much more difficult to pierce, right? It throws data at you that they know you're not going to be able to really parse. And you know, this is the problem is none of the, if you really look at the data, you're like, you don't have a genocide in a place where there's rising population, massively rising income, right? Where the Uyghurs are themselves key figures in all of the government in Xinjiang, where the language is funded by the state. I mean, you know, anything you look at, any measure of macro well-being shows dramatic increases in a short period of time. You know, like the Uyghurs are by every measure we have in social science dramatically better off than they were a few decades ago, by every single measure. How is that commensurate with a genocide?
There's a book called that I read called The Intelligence Trap, and it's about super intelligent people who can sometimes cling to an idea, and then they go so far down with that idea, and they're so smart they can convince themselves of anything. What would it? And I'm not suggesting that's you, but what would it take?
Well, thank you for saying that I'm super intelligent, though. I'll take that part of it.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. This is the thing. And I'll say this in the intro as well. Like, I don't usually debate people. I'm not particularly smart myself, and I don't really know much about any of these things. So I just think it would be interesting for people to hear another side, which is your side. We can debate a bit back and forward. I'm not going to win because I don't know enough. I don't really know what I'm talking about, but it's just interesting to talk to you. But there is, what would it take? Do you ever worry that maybe I mean, we all have cognitive biases, and you're smart enough to be able to, you know, to find logic in yours. What would it take for you to go, oh, you know what? And the reason I ask that is because, oh, sorry, I'm dropping stuff, is because with Russia, Ukraine, I spoke to so many different people, friends of mine and all that, who were pushing the sort of idea that it was, you know, NATO's fault for encroaching, and that's what Putin's upset with and all this stuff. And then Putin came out with basically saying, well, no, we just want Ukraine to be Russian now. And I just thought, are those people who were all saying, no, no, this is all what we did, it's what NATO did, are they now going to turn around and go, oh, God, I was wrong? Or do they go further in and into their ideas?
I don't think it invalidates that. I mean, NATO has encroached quite a bit eastward, right? I mean, you can just look at them up, right? I mean, one could ask the question, why does NATO exist? I mean, NATO was designed explicitly to be, you know, an anti-socialist alliance. And I mean, you know, you could also ask the question, what would the U.S. do? What would the U.S. do if, let's say, Russia or China formed an agreement with Mexico? You know, military alliance. We know the answer. The United States would go nuts, right? It'd go absolutely nuts.
But that's not what Putin said was the reason, though. He said the reason was because we all thought that might be it. So I was keeping quiet when everyone was saying, now it's NATO's fault. But he said, no, 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 we just want Ukraine. And after Ukraine, well, Lithuania, you know, like who else? So what is the point when people go, oh, you know what, I like to believe in the, like, you know, it's our own fault as well. And it is, it's every, you know, there's fault on both sides. But this is maybe bad what Putin's doing.
It might be, you know, there's a long and complex history between Russia and Ukraine, right? But it's gotten a lot hotter since 2013, 2014, you know, with the ouster and so on. And, you know, the direction that Ukrainian politics has taken since then. You know, I think that certainly in the United States, I won't speak for the UK, but in the United States, we have this sort of slippery slope going on. It says, hey, something bad is happening in the world, and the U.S. could intervene and make that a lot better because we're the good guys. I think that's a supremely naive position to believe in that, right? I mean, my position as a socialist, as a communist, is you don't, the working class never benefits from wars between capitalist powers. You know, who's the fodder for that, right? I mean, like, that, who's going to die in these wars? You know, it's going to be the poor, you know? Rich people do not get hurt by war. They profit from it, you know? And then they want to convince us that it's in their interest, in our interest, right? And that it has to do with something called sovereignty that we should care about, or human rights, or democracy. And, you know, the idea that the U.S. is the great respecter of sovereignty, how can people say that with a straight face? I mean, that is absurd, right? I mean, look at the record.
No, but we can criticize. You can criticize both sides, though. You can still say what Putin's doing is mad and greedy and stuff.
Sure. But I don't think you take a both. I don't think you convincingly take a both sides position on this, because there is a power that runs the world. And it's not Russia. You know? Russia just, it stands outside the sphere of U.S. influence. Yeah. I mean, that's the great crime. You know, I think it's interesting that, you know, heads of state and important people in Europe say, we just don't want Russia having more influence. Right. I mean, like Scholz cancels the certification for the Nord Stream 2 extension of the pipeline. Right. This is just a few days ago. Right. Using Ukraine as a pretext. I mean, it's interesting, right? Like, how much do they really care about Ukrainian sovereignty, right? I mean, like, probably not much, right? Like,
not at all. I agree with you, because these are, well, they're politicians, right? And so you're right. You're totally right, I think, to say that the Americans right now, what do they care about? They don't want Russia to have more power. What do the Russians care about? They want to have more power. But one of them is invading a sovereign country and murdering, at the moment, hundreds of people have died.
Well, a part of it, though. Yeah, but a part of it, and a part of it that has voted to actually have this, right? I mean, do they not want to be Russian? I mean, you know, again, a lot of Russians in Ukraine, you know? I mean, like, and especially in these regions. So I don't know. I mean, I find it deeply suspicious when there's this level of duplicity around the real geopolitical interests, right? Like, and so I'm like, you know, if I hear this talk that says, oh, well, it's all about sovereignty, I just don't, you know, I'm like, convince me, you know, because I don't see that.
Let's get on to like the everydays of the communist society that you might hope would exist. I'm a podcaster. I now do this as a profession.
Nice.
How? Thank you. I'm enjoying this. It's a nice job to have. And I worked really, really hard to get it. And I'm really, you know, happy with it. I don't earn a lot of money by anyone's standards, I don't think. But enough to get by. How would that work in a society you're like, you know, let's say I'm 19 years old, 20 years old or whatever, and I think, hey, I want to be a podcaster or a journalist. How does it work in your vision?
You know, as opposed to the path that we know, right, which is that if you don't come from money, you've got to scrape, you've got to make a living, plus you have to have a hobby, which is trying to create your job that you want, right?
That's what I did. That's what I did. I worked two jobs, and I guess you'll say this isn't what people should have to do, but I worked as a copywriter. So I'd do that all day. And then the podcast was like, you know, editing it into the night, slept a few hours every night. And I suppose you'd say that's not how, and I should say, I do come from a middle-class family. You can hear it in my voice, and you know, I don't mean to suggest, and I agree with you that it wouldn't have been as easy to do coming from different kinds of backgrounds.
Yeah. Or, I mean, is it necessary for a person to, in order to create the kind of work that they like, work which is beneficial to society, right? I'll just say that. I don't care how controversial it is. Podcasters improve our lives, people.
Yes. I like that. Especially this one.
So like, here you are, right? Trying to do productive work, which you enjoy, which you're suited for, and which also helps society, right? And you're forced to what? Jump through hoops, work your ass off for, I don't know how long it took you to do this, 10 years? I mean, like, it takes a long time to create the career that you want, you know? I mean, like, maybe it took you less, and if so, I'm glad. But, you know, it can take a lot longer, you know?
It's difficult to put a start and stop, because obviously they're starting as a journalist and doing this and that and trying to make a bigger name and interviewing skills, and the actual podcast itself has been running 18 months and it's just gone sort of professional about a month ago. But I'm also aware that's very, very rare. It typically would take 5-10 years, and the 99.999% never get to do this. So I got very lucky with several things along the way.
Yeah, well, people like the sound of your middle class voice. So
my dulcet tones. Well, I have. You know what I did? It is a bit different. I mean, if you were, which obviously there wasn't as much social media around, but back at school, I did have a bit more of a London, you know, inflection, and people who didn't see me since school days for many years have said to me that I sound, to use a Britishism, quite posh now. And that was part of living abroad, and I was having to speak very clearly so that everybody understood me. And but who knows? But there are plenty of working class podcasters with different accents and things as well, which brighten up the sound, I think.
I just think of, like, you know, because this is a generalized problem, right? This isn't just you. I mean, you're taking a risk, right, as a podcaster, because you're, you know, you're working in a kind of a new field, right? And like you say, you know, most don't make it, right? But even people who are just getting professional training to become a lawyer, let's say, or really anything, right? These people are taking risks. I mean, my training is as an economist, you know, like I was, if you do an economic calculation, if you say, what is the net present value of getting a PhD in economics? It is not positive, right? Like, I mean, you get a career out of it, but it takes so long to complete the training. The training is expensive. And the big factor is the opportunity cost, right? I mean, like, I went to grad school, I could have been earning money right away, right? That puts me negative in terms of net value, right? So, you know, it's actually irrational to become an economist, right? I mean, like, that's a crazy idea, right? Why? Well, because all of the costs of doing that, including the opportunity costs, have been displaced to the individual, right? That's absurd, right? I mean, we have a huge problem in the United States. We have almost $2 trillion of total student loan debt in the United States, right? I mean, and if you want to have more educated professionals, do the opposite of what we do, right? I mean, like, come on, you know, like, you're charging the people who have the least ability to pay for it, right? and dangling this carrot. Oh, hey, you might be able to have a decent career at the end of this. Maybe, you know, if you play your cards right, you may have a decent career at the end of this. Why are decent careers so rare? You know, why isn't every job a decent career? You know, like, I don't care if you're picking up the trash or you're writing legal documents. There should be a kind of minimum decency in your life. You know, there should be no job which makes you desperately poor. But, you know, in the U.S. at least, there's a significant proportion. I mean, you know, there's 40 million people in the U.S. who earn less than $15 an hour. $15 an hour doesn't, you know, is barely enough to take you out of poverty anyway, right? So 40 million people is about a quarter of the U.S. labor force who earn less than that, right? So, but this is what capitalism does, right? I mean, I think I would say, you know, we have this, if you're on the left, you're like, look, college should be free. You know, this is one of Bernie's big proposals. And I'm like, a good step, right? But that's not actually the major obstacle. You know, the major obstacle is you still need to earn a living. You know, college is work. Getting educated is work. I'm of the belief that you should be paid for work. You know, like, you should. And the Soviets actually did this, right? When we look at what the Soviets did, they did some enormously progressive things. You know, in the 1930s, they trained 100,000 women doctors, right? At a time when women are basically property in like a lot of the industrialized world, you know, 100,000 women doctors. I mean, could you be a woman doctor in the United States with all of its vaunted freedom in the 1930s? Medical schools were pretty loath to admit women at the time, right? You know, it's get married, right? You can be a nurse. So, you know, I think we can do a lot better.
On this point, did Stalin not say, he who does not work, neither shall he eat?
Yeah, Stalin made it very clear that the ultimate goal of communism was, like I said, right, like, to each according to need, from each according to ability. But he said, we're not in communism, we're in socialism. And in socialism, you know, you still have to work, right? I mean, like, that's our situation. We're emerging from, you know, an exploitative society, right? The best we can do is, look, the government is going to take the surplus that workers produce, but we're going to try to use it for the general well-being. And see, this is where it becomes, and, you know, in Marxism, this is called the dictatorship of the proletariat, right? That scary word, because it's got dictatorship in it, right? But, you know, the question is, like, how do you then assess, like, well, has the government does that? I mean, every government says that they're doing things for the good of the people, right? Like, but are they actually? And, you know, then you have to get into the weeds a little bit, right? Then you have to start looking at the numbers. Then you've got to use that big brain of yours, right? And say, well, how do we measure how people's lives are, right? Do we just listen to a bunch of stories from people who went to concentration camps or whatever, right? Like, is that what we listen to? We listen to the, you know, the Gulag Archipelago, right? Or do we actually look at data, right? Do we look at the fact that people live twice as long, right? Do we look at the fact that the infant mortality is one-tenth what it used to be, right? I mean—
But that's all industrialization. We've already done the industrialization.
We've already done the industrialization, so we're in a different position here, right? So what would make life better in, you know, for the average Brit or for the average, you know, American, let's say, right? We have to listen to people, right? But I think the big grain thing is, look, you know, everyone should have a decent income, right? You shouldn't be thrown out of your house because real estate prices change and now you can't afford your mortgage, let's say, right? Or, I mean, you know, this happened to millions of people in the Great Recession in the US, right? I think you start with the biggest pain points for people, you know?
I think it's hard, isn't it? Because I think you... Just, and I don't have any empirical data for this, but I wonder if you underestimate the amount of people who are struggling financially, working class people who really do believe in the self-made person. And that might be a lie, the American dream, for example. That might be a lie, but a lot of people like that idea. They like the idea of being able to come from nothing. And it, like I say, might be a falsehood, might be idealism, but some people like it that way. And I do wonder, you know, it's quite hard. I often think about this. It's hard enough just to have a relationship with your, you know, wife or husband or with a friend, because you both want different things. And when you've got a country of 70 million or in the US, 350 million, how hard is that? And if you've got communism, that is this, like I said before, you're not really allowed opposition. And I think a lot of people, even if it's not good for them, and you can say, oh, we think this is good for you, they would say, no, but I want to be this guy who works hard and comes up with an idea and does this thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think, you know, in the US, you would need a transitionary moment that does not abolish small business, right? Because what you're talking about is small business, you know? The American ideal of self-reliance and making it through your own effort, this is not big business, right? This is, you know, it's small business, right? It's an individual who starts a business, maybe with a few other people, right? So I don't think that's the first thing you would outlaw, right? I think you would probably do something like what, you know, like China has a core group of industries, right? Like I think you would take the big corporations and nationalize them, right? And you'd say, now we're going to run these democratically, you know, because you know what a corporation is, right? I mean, you've worked at some of these maybe, right? A corporation is a dictatorship. That's what it is, right? I mean, you have no rights economically, right? You can be fired at any time for any reason, right?
Yeah, but you can leave. You're not going to be sent to Siberia.
Yeah, well, the point is you can be cut off from your livelihood. I mean, leaving is great depending on how much money you have in the bank, right? I mean, if you have a lot, then well, fuck you, I'm out of here, right? Like, but if you don't, you need that. I mean, and especially in the US where it's tied to your healthcare is often tied to that, right? I mean, like the employer has a lot of power and you have almost no say what happens there, right? I'm a believer in democracy. I think you should have a democratic workplace. You're not going to have that ever under capitalism, right? So I think that would be a good step, right? You just say, let's democratize these large corporations. Small business, I care a lot less about. You know, there's 30 million or so small businesses in the United States. Almost all of those are sole proprietorships, maybe 24 million of them or so, right? So we're talking about a relatively small segment, you know, it's not the mainstay. I don't think you start there, you know. I think you say, look, if you want to start a business, okay, you know, that's fine, right? I don't think that's anti-socialist or something like this. But I think I think you could even say to those people who are into that kind of self-reliant, you know, US idea, you say to them, do you think you're better able to start a business if you're guaranteed healthcare or no, right?
Well, we do have that in the UK, the healthcare stuff. And I think that's a huge point. I've lived with it. People in the UK can't believe that you don't get that in the US because we're so used to it now, the NHS. So I would totally agree with you on that. So I just want to go back to me because I always want to talk about me. I want to be a podcaster. I'll come out of university or whatever. And then how do I do? Because right now I earn money through adverts that businesses place, you know, in the podcast. And so what would happen? How would it be decided who gets to be the podcaster? If everybody's, wouldn't everyone do it? How would it work?
Do you think everyone wants to be a podcaster? I wonder how many, would the market get flooded by podcasting?
there are jobs, I think. There are loads of jobs that are like, I wonder if it's like, and this is part of society, and this is now, I'm sort of going off on a tangent as if I'm going to write my own Marx and Engels thing now, right? But I do feel like what I quite like about capitalism, and I accept all the issues that you've raised today about capitalism, right? But what I quite like is that often, not always, but often some of the jobs that are really, really desirable are not as well paid, at least at the beginning, as the ones that are not as desirable, which is why like a corporate lawyer can earn loads of money, right? But the human rights lawyer, which everyone wants to do, because you get another benefit from being a human rights lawyer, you get to tell yourself you're a good person, you get to do good things, you feel good, you're helping people. Doctors often don't get paid very well until they get to the very top, right? But they get to, there's a great thing about being a doctor. It's fantastic, I think, but very, very hard work. So again, with the podcast, I sort of felt like this is going to be an outrageous amount of work. I'm not going to have a social life for several years. I'm taking a huge risk. But the payoff of that is I get to do what I really, really love. So I really liked that mix. And that's just me personally. It doesn't mean that everybody's going to like that. But can you? I worry that that's what would be lost.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that everyone has the same thirst for that. I think if you said to people, we're going to structure the economy so that everyone has just a basic level of decency, you know, and you, your income is going to be adequate for you to live a decent life. Look, period. You know, if that starts changing, if prices creep or whatever, we will take care of it. Right. I think most people would be like, hell yeah. You know, like I mean, and might some say, yes, but I want to do this. And you don't even understand what that is. And then say, well, all right, let's create democratic structures so that, you know, we can fund things like that that we don't currently understand, you know, like, because society is always in movement and change, right? We have to appreciate that and even celebrate it, right? But I think that's at the margin, you know. I don't know that that's everyone, right? You know, the thing that people often say is that you're a socialist. Well, but why would anyone pick up the trash, right? Why would anyone do that job because it's so stinky and terrible, right? Like, and this is always funny to me, you know, because I'm like, being like a sanitation worker in the United States tends to be unionized. It tends to be a fairly good job, actually, right? I mean, it's a desirable job if you like having decent pay and benefits, right? I mean, like, the kind of people who raise that issue are people who have never done that job. They don't, you know, like, it's kind of coming at it from this like abstract perspective, you know. My thing is, like, work is not inherently pleasant or unpleasant, right? It is the circumstances that surround it that make it so, right? So, you know, picking up trash or digging holes or breaking up concrete or whatever it is, right? I mean, these are all things I've done, by the way, right? Like this, I'm not just, you know, spitballing here. Yes, I've spent most of my life in academia, but I've done lots of different jobs, you know? So, you know, it's not the work itself, right? It's the context of that, and particularly the exploitation. Can you pay your rent or not, right? I mean, like, and these are the things that we could have an immediate impact on. You know, we could make jobs just better, right? I mean, why don't we start there?
But you say, so the you know, picking up garbage or whatever, so that's maybe not a job a lot of people would want to do, but as you say, it's unionized, it has good benefits and stuff. So isn't that kind of the point? Like, because it's paid well, the opposite of the doctor one, you're not paid well, you've got terrible hours and stuff, but it's a job that a lot of people would aspire to do because of the prestige and what it means to be a doctor. A lot of people, and I don't mean...
You should say something like physician assistant or something like that, or I don't know what the right term is. It's a low-level nurse, right? Because that's the real grunt work in medicine, right? Not being a doctor, you know. There's lots of low paid, what are they called, medical assistant or something. I forget all the terms. I'm not in that field, so I don't. There's a whole level of spectrum of different things, at least in the U.S. And a lot of these are very low paid, and they're very hard work, and there isn't a lot of opportunity for career advancement, right? Like, just like lots of other places in capitalism, right? I mean, like, if you work as a retail clerk, where's your next step up from that? You know, going to become the CEO of that corporation? I doubt it, right? That's a dead end job. Typically
could be the manager of a store.
Maybe you could become the manager, right? But can everybody do that? Right. I mean, like, you know, this is a,
the best rise to the top.
Do they?
Yeah. Well, obviously not always, but the issue as well, and I'm sure you've heard this one before. I mean, anything I throw at you, you've heard 1,000 times, you must be tired of hearing, but you know, in a society, especially if you look at a communist society, like 1 to 3% of the world are psychopaths, right? So they might take advantage, and that seems to have happened in the past. And then also a certain percentage of people are, and it's not popular to say, but then what you're saying is not very popular either, but it's not popular to say, but some people are a bit lazy. And I might be lazy if I didn't have more incentive. So the lazy people and the psychopaths, they're a problem for communism, aren't they?
Well, let's turn the question on their head. Are they a problem for capitalism? I mean, the psychopaths tend to end up running corporations, let's say, right? If they're well connected, right? If not, they just become serial killers, you know?
Yeah.
If they're poor. So, I mean, do you want to have a psychopath running your dictatorship workplace?
I think we have a psychopath probably running the UK. And I think there's probably one right now running the US. I think the previous one running the US was also one. I think a lot of world leaders are on the verge of being, because to want to have that much power, I think you have to be at least, you know, somewhere towards being, it's on a spectrum, of course.
So capitalism has a psychopath problem too, yeah.
But they let limited power. There's only so much that Boris can do. There's only some, and we saw with Obama, he wanted to get rid of guns or whatever, and he couldn't even do it. There's the lack of power in a capitalist society that isn't totalitarian is like the safety net for these psychopaths who lead countries.
Well, not if you lead a corporation, though. There's not much of a safety net there.
Look, Amazon is atrocious, you know, and I had someone on this podcast talking about he infiltrated Amazon to work in one of the warehouses and sort of expose what goes on, and it is disgusting. And the fact that they're allowed to get away without paying people, because they just don't pay people, It's awful. And Bezos, with the money he's got, like, he needs another billion. So I couldn't agree with you more in that respect. But again, it's not the same as, you know, the great... And I know you're saying it's different times, right? But I have to say these points because people afterwards are going to shout at me for, you didn't even mention the great famine of 14.5 million people died from starvation. The fact that Stalin executed 81 of the highest ranking 103 members of the Communist Party. These are things that Boris right now or Biden are not able to do to their opposition.
Well, right. But, you know, so I think we're on the same page, though, because you're saying, if I could paraphrase it, you're saying it's democracy that is the great antidote to the concentration of power, which rewards the psychopath, right? And I could not agree more. I think we should extend democracy. I think we should have real democracy. You know, like if your boss says you're fired, do you get to say, let's vote on it? No, you do not. Right. I mean, like, that's a dictatorship. Right. I mean, like, you know, we should have real democracy in the places where we actually spend most of our time, which is at work. We should have some control over these huge economic entities, right? These corporate bodies. They should not be in private hands. We should not cede the control over that to a few psychopaths. We should actually vote on that, right? And, you know, I think that that does a lot to prevent the concentration of power that you worry about. But, you know, we've also been told a bunch of lies about this, frankly, about the Soviets. You know, the Soviets did have democracy. It's incorrect to frame that as a dictatorship where Stalin had unlimited power. Even the CIA admits to that, right? The CIA has a document where they say, you know, Stalin works with his, you know, he has far less power than what we tell everybody in our propaganda, you know. You know, the Soviet constitution is actually quite good. You know, I think we have this idea already, right? We have the idea that democracy is good. That's a pretty widespread idea. That forces the capitalists of the world into a very awkward position because they're like, yay, democracy. But at the same time, they have to undermine it at every turn, right? Because a powerful political force emerges, somebody who says, hey, let's make college free for everybody. Let's give everyone a decent wage. Let's give everyone healthcare. Somebody like Bernie Sanders must be destroyed, right? And every tactic will be used to derail that candidacy, even though it's massively popular, right? I mean, this is, and everyone can see this, right? Everyone can see this is totally anti-democratic. We're not actually doing democracy. We're doing this bizarre caricature of it, right?
Well, when we talk about democracy, we're talking about politically. I don't think we're talking about private businesses and things like that. And also, isn't a private business essential for the private home? And I'm not even sure that I know what that means, but I read that if you want to debate a communist, you need to say that because don't appeal to, like, if somebody in the 19th century said this, it was like, don't appeal to, like, oh, come on, you're being naive, because it's giving away that maybe you're a bit more hardened than they are and they have better morals than you. And don't appeal to other things. What you need to say is that communism doesn't allow for private property and homes, and to have real freedom, you need to have your own home.
No, everyone should have a home, right? Everyone should have a home. Private property, communists are against private property, meaning you shouldn't have one person that owns all the homes, right? You know, a person should own one home. How many do you really need, right? I mean, like, you need one. Maybe you need another one to go on a vacation or something, but, like, that's pretty much a waste anyway, right? Like, I mean,
who gets the nice ones? Because I lived in Berlin, right? And it's horrible. Like, East Berlin, I was living there for 3 years. And it is all horrible. Everything's rubbish and not nice. And, of course, you know, all the museums, you see all the old cars they had, all the horrible things before the wall fell. The funny thing is, and I think this is, you know, in your defense, when you speak to a lot of the old East Berliners or East Germans, a lot of them are very proud of how it was, and they say it wasn't so bad. So I can see how a different kind of person who isn't like me and isn't like a lot of, you know, they might have enjoyed that. I just think, but also you weren't allowed to leave your country. Information wasn't allowed in or out. People were spying on you the whole time. Surveillance, people turning against each other. So it's just a case of, we talk about democracy. To me, that's not freedom and democracy.
Yeah, but, you know, you have to look at that socialism is an island amidst a sea of hostile capitalist imperialist powers, right? That's the situation, you know? So socialism in Russia was this welcomed by the rest of the world? You know, did the rest of the world say, wow, interesting, a political experiment, let's see how it plays out? No, 14 nations immediately invaded it on the side of the monarchists, right? I mean, like, and, you know, this is the third bloodiest conflict of the 20th century. I mean, they made it very clear that they're willing to kill millions of people, tens of millions of people, to prevent socialism from, to strangle it in its infancy, right? And then you have the Nazis, right? The Nazis saying that they're going to be to invade, right? Being funded, being supported, right? No one is making alliances against the, you know, the Soviets are forced into making a, you know, a kind of a standoff, right, with the Soviets. Because, yes, everyone is hoping, you know, okay, they'll invade and destroy socialism, right? And against all odds, the Soviets managed to win. So, you know, do they do some authoritarian things along the way? Yeah, so that they're not destroyed. I mean, like, that's the context, right? Like, when you have a world that is bent on your destruction, you might have to restrict a few things, you know, like, do you have a problem with spies? Come on, watch a James Bond movie sometime, right? I mean, like, that stuff is real, you know, like, there were there's an enormous investment in spying and surveillance, right, to try to destroy the Soviet Union, right? That's a real thing, you know? So, like, what do? Right? You either say, oh, okay, well, we can't restrict anything. I guess we'll die as a state and be replaced by a capitalist oligarchy, right? They eventually managed to do that, right, with some help from the inside. Or you could say, all right, we're going to limit some things, you know? We're going to have to limit some mobility.
Does, like, every country has to do it, has to adopt the kind
of... Every country has to do it, yeah.
That's not going to happen.
Well, I mean, the Soviets had, you know, they had a certain naivete when the revolution was successful, they said, we've done it, comrades, and pretty soon the rest of the world will follow. You know, I mean, that's really what they thought in those early days. And then it started to become clear, that's not going to happen. We're on our own here, you know? And what a moment that must have been, right? To be like, we thought the workers of the world were going to rise up, but it's just us. Oh my God, right? I mean, that's a rather different situation.
Let's go put loads of people in gulags and murder them.
If they're working with the Japanese, if they're working with the Nazis, I mean, what choice do you have, you know? You could die, I guess. That's your other choice.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and really, really fascinating. I've learned loads of stuff as well. And I'm very happy for capitalism. I just like it and all that stuff. But I really respect how you debate and how you have your kindly Santa Claus but slim nature about you. So thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Assatar Bear, for coming on the Edge with me, Andrew Gold, for a clear and frank discussion about communism and Stalinism. Come on, he's a nice guy, even if he defends a mass murderer. To be clear, I think Stalin is one of the most vicious and psychopathic dictators in history. I'm aware that many listeners will have family and relatives who were affected directly by Stalin's atrocities. But for Assatar, Stalin appears to be more of a product of his time. I hope that's not misrepresenting his views. Remember to follow Assatar on @AssatarBear or go to youtube.com/AssatarBear for more of his stuff. Follow me on @AndrewGold_OK. I don't think I really held my own in that conversation. I'm starting to worry that to call this a debate is a little disingenuous, but that's partly due to my lack of knowledge compared to an economics professor specializing in this particular subject, and partly also because I try not to interrupt too much in this podcast. You've heard the views of a paedophile, a psychopath, a man who taught his dog to Nazi salutes, a woman who says she can remember being in the womb, and now a Stalinist. And, you know, what a dinner party that would make for. I do love talking about the things we're not supposed to talk about. And I hope you do too. Join me in a few days to discuss disconnecting from social media and technology with famous podcaster Emma Gannon. And coming up soon, our anti-woke and anti-religion comedian Stephen Knight back on the show, Dr. Shahom Das for some more true crime stories, and documentary maker Chris Atkins, who was arrested for tax fraud or something like that, he'll explain it, and spent 2.5 years in prison, Wandsworth, documenting all of it in a book. It's a fascinating look behind the bars. Hope you stick around for those.